Virginia Prescott. Today, NHBR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Sonia Sotomayor, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
Oye, Barreto viene ya, ritmo sabroso pago.
When President Barack Obama nominated the first Hispanic and third female Supreme Court justice back in 2009, he championed the real-world experiences of a woman born to Puerto Rican immigrants and raised in the housing projects of the South Bronx and Queens.
Sonia's father was a factory worker with a third-grade education who didn't speak English. But like Sonia's mother, he had a willingness to work hard, a strong sense of family, and a belief in the American dream.
Sonia Sotomayor went on to excel at Princeton and Yale before embarking on a legal career as a public prosecutor, a private litigator, and judge. She gives readers a remarkably candid view of her life before becoming a judge in her best-selling memoir, My Beloved World. I have ventured to write more intimately about my personal life than is customary for a member of the Supreme Court, Justice Sotomayor says in the preface to My Beloved World. Readers do get an unvarnished look at her material poverty of managing the chronic illness of diabetes from the age of 7, the aftermath of her father's death from alcoholism, and the psychic wounds of being one of few outsiders in the Ivy League. Sonia Sotomayor's rise to the nation's highest court is a story of fierce determination, unflappable will, and considerable knowledge. Attributes all on display for the sold-out crowd at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, all of whom traveled through a blizzard to see her live. Justice Sotomayor, today people were asking whether or not this event would be held tonight, you know, whether you'd get through the snow. And I said to my colleagues, I read this book. This woman can do anything.
But if you read the book, you know it's always with help.
Right.
And I surround myself with wonderful people. And the wonderful people who got me here are public servants, the United States Marshals, that were with me in Pittsburgh last night and who heard that my plane was canceled, and they figured out a plan of driving me last night from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. It took us 8 hours. They drove through a blizzard, sleet, and ice for all of that time. We arrived in Philly at 7 this morning, and at 10 o'clock, I was on an Excella here. You know, in this day and age when we're sometimes disappointed in the way government functions, it is really important to remember that we have public servants who do their job in heroic yeoman and yeowoman-like ways and who are dedicated. I thank them.
Well, I can say personally that it is an honor. But we are speaking to a justice of the Supreme Court, so I just want to let everybody know that off base will be any prior or pending cases. We're going to be talking about her story, which is so rich and wonderful that I'm sure we won't be disappointed. Yes, you did figure out that asking for help was essential in your life. But early in your life, you had what you called an existential independence. And as early as 7 years old, you were becoming self-reliant. I'm thinking of the story that you tell in the book about giving yourself your insulin shots when it was discovered that you had juvenile diabetes. Can you tell us that story?
This is really the first chapter of the book. I had to find a vehicle in the book to introduce my family, to introduce the family dynamic. And so as I thought about my youth, I realized that on many levels, my diagnosis of diabetes was a major turning point in my life. It's a condition that altered my eating habits, that altered my self-perceptions about my health, and fundamentally altered my expectations of my future. And so I felt that it provided a wonderful backdrop to all of those issues. And what happened was that I got out of the hospital. The first morning, Mom gave me my shot. My mother, who was then a practical nurse, was so anxiety-ridden, I can't say nervous, but so unhappy, that I saw the resolve in her face, and she sort of turned steel cold, and she reared back, and it was like she punched me in the arm. The next day, when my dad did it, he trembled so much that I was afraid he was going to hit me somewhere in the face or neck, okay? And he hurt too, okay? Imagine somebody giving you a shot when they're shaking, okay? The third day, I got up, which was a Sunday, and they were arguing, as they did quite frequently, about who would give me the shot. And the familiar themes of my family's fighting, my father's alcoholism, my mother's need to work to help support the family, all of those things came out, as did some of the things that frightened me. The fact that I would need these shots for the rest of my life, the fact that someone would likely have to give them to me. And as I was listening to this, I realized that what they were saying was that I was going to not be able to stay with my grandmother, who was my refuge and my protector in life. And I knew, because I knew her, that it would be too painful for her to give me that injection. And I knew I had to do it myself.
So at 7 years old, you learned how to sterilize the needle by boiling the water, checking and making sure that there were no air bubbles in it, and giving yourself a shot. I mean, this isn't... When I was 7 years old, I used to run away from the doctor when he was giving shots.
Well, I tell the story in the book that the first time they took blood out of my arm, the doctor kept saying, "This looks worse. It won't hurt as much." And he kept coming closer and closer, and the needle got bigger and bigger in my eyes. And he's about right at my vein. And I looked at him, and I looked at the needle, and I said, "No!" I jumped out of the chair, right past the operator, outside, underneath the car. So, I wasn't that different. Mm-hmm. But I think, as you were as a kid, but I think that I had already gone through being scared by everything, mm-hmm. scared by my mother's reaction, and my father's, by my grandmother's reaction and my feelings and statements when they thought I was asleep in another room, that this was something that was dire. But my point is that at that point, I had a need to take some control over this condition.
Well, it's also a little characteristic of your family dynamic. One of the things about the candor of this book is that you let the adults in your life be complicated human beings. And your father was an alcoholic, but he was also a warm-hearted man who you describe becoming almost monstrous as he drank. His face would sort of contort and twist, and he would lumber around and become this heavy presence. And oftentimes when children are born into alcoholic families, they adopt skills. You know, they learn how to read the room. And I wonder if for you, the law was appealing because it was ordered. It was codified. It had beginnings and ends in a way that a childhood with that much uncertainty may not have had.
It didn't. And you're right. It was a palliative to chaos, to anger, because as most people who have family relations where someone is dependent, whether it's on alcoholism, pills, or drugs, there's generally a lot of strife in the home. And the law did seem to me as a way of normalizing the relationship. Not ideal, but at least ordered.
You're listening to a conversation with Sonia Sotomayor for Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth and presented by NHPR and the Music Hall. Well, you talk about your experiences and the insecurities that plagued you as you were growing up, or especially when you went into Princeton, entered the Ivy League, the things that you were so insecure about.
I still have them. I'm on the Supreme Court and I'm still insecure. people talk as though they've left me, okay? I talk about in the book that insecurities are a constant part, I think, of most people in some form. Mm. I think if you don't feel a little bit of anxiety in a new setting, then there may be something emotionally wrong with you. only because I'm only jesting. But I think any new experience brings the unknown.
There was also a lot of your culture that separated you from at least your peers at that time in the Ivy League, certainly.
Absolutely. I had vastly different life experiences from most of my classmates at Princeton.
Well, and I'm also wondering about now. I mean, you write in the book about your grandmother, this warm, wonderful woman you just described, your abuelita, conducting seances, I guess, is, for lack of a better word. She was a healer. She would channel spirit voices.
My grandfather.
Well, how did that go? I can't imagine that being in Chief Justice John Roberts' memoir for some reason. So... How have the other justices on the court responded to your book?
This is very funny. you know, one of the purposes of my book and why I chose to be as candid as I was is I have learned through the school of hard knocks, and I describe some of it in my book, that there's a cost for hiding things from people. Mm-hmm. And that there's an advantage to sharing with people. When you show people your vulnerability, more often than not, I'm not going to say always, but more often than not, people will open themselves to you. I tell this story because reflective of that was the fact that my colleague, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, like all of us on the court, during a term, the book came out in January, and that's smack in the middle of our term. Nobody can read a book from cover to cover very fast. You read it in chapters over a number of weeks, days or weeks. But every time she read a couple of chapters, when she next saw me, she would share something that was similar in her life. Mm. Others, like Steve Breyer, said to me, "I think I understand you now." Others haven't said anything, but I think that's just... I'm sure they've had thoughts about my grandmother and thoughts about me. But I've given them the opportunity, if they choose, to open themselves more to me. And some have.
Here's a question from the audience. Is there an informal sisterhood between the three female justices and a recognition of the hurdles you shared, a perspective you bring that had been muted for 200 years?
Recently, we were at either a conference or lunch, the justices, and we were all talking about periods in the court's life where there had been really overt hostility and anger between and among justices. And one of my colleagues says, "When did that change and why?" And Justice Ginsburg piped up, "When you started having women on the court." Oh. All right. And I actually sat back to think about it and realized it's not that some of us are not confrontational or sort of assertive. One day, Justice Scalia looked at me and said, "Sonia, I love you. You're just like me. You're a pit dog when you have something that you want to convince somebody about." It's not that. But I do think that as women, we bring a relationship to the table, a sort of humanity to the relationship that might be different. And so do we as women on the court have a special relationship? I think so. Justice Ginsburg, there's a tradition on the court that when someone's nominated, they don't reach out to the person until the Senate has finally confirmed them, which all of my colleagues did. But the first week, I got a little package from Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a note wishing me luck and giving me a collar and telling me that she hoped I'd have use of it soon.
One of those lacy collars?
One of that she wears, yes. One that she wears. And she has shared with both me and Justice Kagan her Chambers book, which is the compilation by every justice of their internal practices and the reasons why that are then passed on from year to year to law clerks. And she was the only one who thought of sharing that with us. And yes, there's a camaraderie, but it doesn't mean that we don't have deep-rooted friendships with our other colleagues. I think it's very, very well known that Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia are great buddies. And Justice Kagan goes hunting with Justice Scalia.
Well, of course, you all bring to it your own experience. And I was fascinated to read about when you did finally get to the Ivy League. You actually didn't know what the Ivy League was. Nor, you know, you grew up reading Encyclopedia Britannica and Reader's Digest and the Bronxville Housing Projects and then in Co-op City. I'm curious about other things you feel like you didn't know, and maybe a little bit about that first Ivy League experience. I was really amused to read about your first visit to Harvard.
I took a train to Harvard, and it was a rainy, soggy day. I was drenched by the time I got off the train, and then I got into there. I don't know, what are the trains called in Boston?
Oh, the T.
The T. I got off the T, and I'm looking around Boston and Cambridge, and I'm thinking to myself, this is as much a city as New York City is. But at any rate, I walk into the office where I was meeting the person who is going to be interviewing and talking to me. And I walk into a room, and there I see this perfectly coiffured woman with this platinum silver hair, the most magnificent set of pearls, necklace, and earrings, two white chairs, a wingback chairs, a white couch, the most spectacular red oriental rug. And all of a sudden, out of my daze at this vistage, I see and hear two little yapping things. I look down, and there's a black and white poodle at her feet. Now, as I just say in my book, I came from a family where nobody owned anything that was white. And nobody owned furniture that wasn't covered in plastic. And I was dumbfounded. As you can tell, I'm usually not at a loss for words. It may be one of the few times where I just couldn't talk to this woman. I don't know. I don't think I was there 10 or 15 minutes. I can't tell you a word that we exchanged. I fled. I ran out of that room. I went to the assistant who was outside and said to her, you know, I've got to get home. Would you tell the students who are coming to pick me up that I had to leave? And I retraced my steps home. I walked into my apartment at home, and my mother looked at me and said, why are you here? You were supposed to stay there overnight. And my response was, Mom, I don't belong there. And it is really strange to say that, because then I went to Princeton. But the difference was in my interview experience. At Princeton, there was the friend who had encouraged me to apply to the Ivy League schools. He's the one who met me at the bus. He's the one who introduced me to his friends. And as to be expected, his friends were closer to our life experiences. And so it was less intimidating to me.
You're listening to my conversation with Sonia Sotomayor for Writers on a New England Stage. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
Well, even though there were people who were sympathetic souls at Princeton, it was there that in a work-study job you were doing data input, and you had access to the financial records of your classmates. And this was a revelation to you, right?
It was amazing. It was the upper echelon. No. There had been a survey done of the more well-to-do members of my class, and almost all of the kids were earning $25,000, $30,000 during the summer. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, what kind of jobs are they doing? You know, I worked every summer and I wasn't earning anywhere near that. I was at minimum wage. And I was like in a state of shock. I finally realized at the end of the survey, putting two and two together, that they were working at daddy's firm, business, getting paid that much money to pay their tuition. Mm-hmm. And I presume that the business was taking off the payment as a tax deduction. I think the government has closed that loophole. But this was the early part of this sort of thinking. And I was shocked at the amount of money that I saw people earning. Look, I made a friend in Princeton, an African-American man who I ended up liking a whole lot. He was from not a military family. His dad was in the military. But his dad and his uncles were all doctors. And he spent an entire bus ride back to New York with me complaining about the fact that he was the son of the poorest member of their family, because all of his uncles were in private practice making much, much more money than his dad. And at one point, I got up the nerve to say, so how much is your dad earning in the military? And he said, well, maybe $80,000 or $100,000. Spent the rest of the ride listening to him. And when I got off the bus, I looked at him and said, not my friend, but his name, it is somewhat hard for me to understand this. My mom supports us on $5,000 a year. But that showed you how different the life was that I had walked into.
But you never write about being angry or resentful. It was actually when you were visiting Yale, I believe, in a similar looking at colleges, that you are turned off by the kind of victimization, by the throaty kind of, we are the minorities and we're not getting our due. You know, a lot of people could take this tack and say, like, I'm going to fight against this. My family lives on $5,000 a year.
But you know, I think there's value to some people fighting about that. People who protest and people who point to the unfairnesses in life have a role. They make us not complacent about situations that are unequal, about unfairness. So I don't criticize those people.
Why do you think it wasn't your tack?
Because it's not my personality. You know, I talk in the book about the fact that even though I'm assertive in the courtroom and I was an assertive lawyer, I'm not an angry, confrontational person. Mm-hmm. Sarcasm is not my strong suit. And there are some lawyers who use sarcasm to great effect in the courtroom. But you have to judge yourself, your own strengths, and figure out what approaches, A, make you happy, and B, help you do positive things. And so, no, the revolution wasn't my tactic of doing things. I worked from within. Mm-hmm. It's what I've done my entire life to affect sometimes small changes, sometimes slightly bigger changes. But I knew that it was my way.
Well, it was at Princeton that you did embrace some level of activism. You joined the Acción Puertorriqueña, and then...
That's pretty good.
I did my best.
Don't leave out the amigos. We were so few in number at Princeton
y amigos.
That we took in anybody who didn't have a group. So Native Americans joined us. Anybody who didn't have a group, they came to our group.
And then later at Yale, the Latino Asian Native American group, the LANA group.
I told you, the same thing. We weren't big enough in numbers to have a group by ourselves.
But this is, you write, the students there at Yale especially were eager to assimilate as quickly and as thoroughly as possible, bearing any attendant challenges and psychic costs. In private. What were the psychic costs?
You know, when you walk into or leave an environment that you grew up in, there can be a great danger of disconnecting with the very people who have nurtured and raised you, with the people who have been a fundamental part of your life. I bet if I ask everyone in this room what their favorite meal is, that the vast majority of people would talk about a dish that either their mother or grandmother cooked, whose flavor and taste has never left their memory. But when you decide to move into a totally different environment, assimilate by forgetting where and what you came from, the psychic cost is of disconnection. Of often feeling as if you're unrooted from the plantation that started you. That's why I think it is important and has been to me never to forget where I came from, what I've been a part of, and to learn how to live in the worlds that I've entered. And so for me, it was a fine balance, but one that I have maintained throughout my entire life, because who Sonia is her family. It's the memories of my grandmother. It's the seances and my cousins and I laughing about them. It's my grandmother's rice and bean soup that no one has ever duplicated.
But do you feel that those cultural awarenesses have had a positive influence on your fellow Supreme Court justices? And if so, how?
You know, at the end of my first year, the law clerks put on a roast of the justices, and we all attend. That first year, part of the roast was introducing me and roasting me for my entry into the court. And the show ended with one of the law clerks taking me out to dance salsa. So we're dancing salsa, and I decide, oh, this is no fun, me dancing up here by myself. And I went out and grabbed every one of the justices. And they all danced.
Really? Could they get down?
Yep. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had just lost her husband, got up and did it. And so I don't know what influence I have on them as individuals. I'm not even sure what influence I'll have on the court. People think that 5 years on the court is a long time. In the life of a justice, that's a drop in the bucket. It's the beginning of you developing yourself, your jurisprudence, your views on what being a justice means to you and to your view of the development of law. And so I'm at the very beginning of my judicial life as a justice. And so I'm still sort of adjusting, learning the ropes. But I think this year I've begun to realize that I'm a little bit more comfortable. And in fact, this year I have actually changed my work schedule. I used to work the weekends before oral arguments, Saturday and Sunday, full days in the office. And now I decided that I'm not going to go in either morning till noon. And I try to do something with the morning, so I explore D.C. a little bit.
We have a lot of questions about that, your daily routine, how she fits in your meals and exercise and sleep and, you know, what you have for lunch.
You know, Generally, on Sundays, on my way home, I stop at the supermarket and I buy my provisions for the week for breakfast and lunch, which I have at the office. And so it's usually simple, not too complex, but it's something healthy and quick, okay? I go to the gym during the week, minimum 2 times. I try to go on the weekend once. I like exercising. And in September, I bought a bicycle, and one of the Saturday morning things I've been doing is exploring D.C., Virginia, and Maryland by biking. At one time in my life, I rode a century 100 miles. I'm out of shape now. I don't know if I can get back there, but I'm going to try. What are my days like? For the young students here, they're going to think a little boring. I spend most of my days when I'm not in court reading, thinking, and writing. That's the life of a justice. We are reading the briefs that lawyers have given us. We're reading our own cases so that we can apply them to the new set of facts before us. We're thinking about how to resolve those cases. And we're writing not just opinions. Often, we're writing memos to each other. The memos can have to do with our views of a draft that someone else has circulated, or other times it's an issue that has arisen in a case that we're considering whether we're going to take it and hear oral argument. But in the midst of all of that, I'm meeting with groups, and we get hundreds of thousands of people who visit the Supreme Court. I invite everybody in this audience, if you've never been to your nation's capital, our nation's capital, go. First of all, it's one of the few cities that I've been to where virtually all of the museums are free. It's also relatively affordable. But more importantly, the capital affects you because the things that happen there affect your lives. The Supreme Court gives wonderful tours, so does the Capitol. Almost all of the public buildings, like the Library of Congress, is the most amazing tour you could ever take. If you haven't been there, then you're missing the greatest library in the world. And so my day, yes, sounds boring, unless you recognize that what I'm doing, I'm passionate about. Being a voice in making some of the most important legal decisions that face the country is an incredible privilege. And because it is a privilege, it's important for me never to abuse it, to be as well prepared in making my decisions as I humanly can be, and to spend as much time as I need reading, thinking, and writing, so that at least my vote is well informed.
Thank you. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor there, talking about the power and responsibility of serving on the nation's highest court. My conversation with her was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the most controversial lines from her memoir, My Beloved World. We'll also hear her advice to young girls growing up today and get a sense of why it's not easy for a Supreme Court justice to date. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for Writers on a New England Stage with Sonia Sotomayor, a special edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're back with Writers on a New England Stage with Sonia Sotomayor, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. She is the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice, the only one to have ever thrown out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium, and the sole justice yet to appear on Sesame Street. Here she is, counseling Abby Kadabi on career choices.
A career is a job that you train for and prepare for and plan on doing for a long time.
Ooh, I know what career that I want to have.
What's that?
I want a career as a princess. Career! Ta-da!
Abby, pretending to be a princess is fun, but it is definitely not a career.
It's not?
No.
Her path from housing project to Ivy League to prosecutor to litigator to judge is the subject of her best-selling memoir, My Beloved World. We spoke earlier about some of the relative disparities and challenges which shaped her and in some cases hardened her. I asked her about a pivotal moment in the book. It was after she graduated from Yale Law School and was working as assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She was becoming fluent in the legal and procedural aspects of an extremely demanding job, but growing increasingly distant from her own heart. It was then that she got some good advice about connecting to the humanity of those on trial and those deciding their fate.
The DA's office was broken up into what others would call divisions or departments. And I was in a trial division or department, a bureau. One of my bureau chiefs I went to talk to after I lost two cases back to back. And he sat me down and he said, "Tell me what you did." And I recited the evidence in both cases, and he was very patient listening to me. And I looked at him at the end and I said, "I shouldn't have lost these cases. I don't know why I did." And he looked and he said, "You haven't convinced the jury that it was their obligation to convict."
What meaning was?
When he explained it to me, it made eminent sense to me. It's hard to judge another human being. There is nothing easy about sitting in judgment about the facts of a case that may affect deeply another person. And judges can tell jurors all they want, "Don't think about the punishment, that's my job." But I think most jurors, it enters their mind. And what my bureau chief was trying to explain to me, and which he did explain to me, you have to, in the trial, get jurors to understand that it is their civic responsibility to convict if the evidence is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And the only way you can do that is to show them your passion about being right and to show them your integrity in the work as you're presenting it to them. And I never lost a case after that. I took his advice and thought about how sort of black and white and, you know, this is the evidence. The facts, ma'am. You remember Dragnet, right? That's what I had been as a prosecutor up to that point. But I became a different lawyer. I understood that lawyering is about persuasion. It's about convincing people that what you're saying is right. And so that changed me as a lawyer. And I think ultimately it helped change me as a person because I realized that those attributes, passion, connectivity with people, those are life skills. And they're life skills that draw you closer to people.
Well, I'm thinking about your narrative of your marriage. You were married when you were quite young. And
High school sweethearts,
mm-hmm. Right? And you started the job at the DA's office, working really hard, trying to find your feet. And your marriage broke up, and you say that it was the demands of the job, and your husband felt that you didn't really need him.
Of any passage that created more controversy among all of my readers, it was that passage. What,
really? Why do you think?
As most of them explained it, and it was more controversy by the women in my life. You know, I had a number of women friends who read the book, the draft of the book. First of all, some feared that I would scare off any other potential man in my life. That was some of the guys, okay? And then some of my women friends thought that it might feel insulting to some other women for me to say that need shouldn't be a part of love. And so they forced me to explain what I meant in a more nuanced way. And I think I hope I accomplished that in the book. My husband felt that that existential self-reliance that I had meant that I didn't need him. He said to me as we were breaking up, "I always felt that if I died tomorrow, you would cry, but you would pick up the day after." And that hurt. It really hurt to hear him say that, because I loved him. And I knew that at least for between both of us, there had been real love at some point. That I didn't make him feel important enough in my life was my failure. But I wasn't sure that that had to translate into need. To need someone is different than to want someone. And I think that difference is what guides me, to want to share a life with another person. And I haven't given up hope I'll meet somebody. I understand it's a little intimidating. But I am the eternal optimist.
Well, I think it must be difficult after growing up as you did. Even though you had examples of true warmth, you also had a lot of pain. You had a very beloved cousin, Nelson. Mm-hmm. You say you were almost twins when you were kids, who became a heroin addict and actually died of AIDS. I'm so sorry, because the descriptions of him are so warm and beautiful.
Can I tell you a story?
Please.
The only person who I shared, besides my brother and my mother, who I shared a draft of the book with was Nelson's sister, my cousin Miriam. When you read the book, and I hope you will, you'll know how important she is in my life, and she's an amazing woman. But I felt I needed her and her mother's permission to share Nelson's story with the world. Miriam apparently read the book. She started after dinner one night and spent the entire night and through the night reading it. And the next morning, she called me up and said that after she finished it, she couldn't stop crying. She said she had talked to her mom and that they had both agreed that I was bringing Nelson back alive and that I was giving his life the potential of meaning. And she said that if his story could help even one child avoid his path, then it was worth telling the story. So I'm really grateful to my cousin, because I loved Nelson, and she knows that. By the way, there were members of my uncle's family who had not known Nelson died of AIDS.
Oh, my goodness.
So the book was quite a disclosure.
You're listening to my conversation with Sonia Sotomayor for Writers on a New England Stage. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
How about for your mother? I'm wondering about that, because you go through some difficult times with your mother when you were young. You mentioned your father was an alcoholic. She worked a lot. She may have kept herself out of the family, out of the household anyway. And there was a sense of abandonment there. What does she think of this book?
My mother, like Justice Ginsburg, because of her aging eyes can't read in one sitting. So she was reading it. She read it in three installments, three consecutive nights. And every night she called me crying. The first night, she ended with chapter 7, which is my favorite chapter of the book. It's a chapter of my mom's life. What I don't know if I got across enough in the book or not is that my mom and I spent a lot of time working through our relationship. We really had worked at coming to terms with each of our emotions, not just about each other, but about the life that she had had, I had and was having. And I knew that by the time I wrote this book, that my mother would understand. And she did. My mother said that when she finished the book, that she heard my voice in her ears. So I knew that the book had really gotten my voice in.
Well, you so vividly speak of growing up, and at a point in the book, I think it maybe when you were working for the DA, you realized that what I learned in my childhood among the Latinos of the Bronx proved to be as relevant to my success as Ivy League schooling was. Now, I wonder about that, those experiences, and I've got a question here from the audience that may actually ask this in another way. It says, I grew up in the Smith Projects on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I was the only sibling to leave the projects and wondered what you thought about the resiliency in people of our backgrounds. A teacher believed in me.
You'll read in my book that I believe that no successful person exists unless they find that one teacher, that one person in their life who believes in them. Mine was my grandmother. She gave me unconditional love. Your teacher must have given you confidence. You don't live in the world that I grew up in public housing, in South Bronx, which is Fort Apache. Some of people here may remember that Fort Apache, when I was growing up, was the most crime-ridden neighborhood in the nation. It's a hard life to grow up in that neighborhood. But one of the purposes of my book was to remind people that in all of those environments, whether it's the South Bronx or the poorest neighborhood in New Hampshire or the streets of Chicago, the tough streets of Chicago, there are human beings there who are living lives with the hopes and dreams that everybody in this audience has. And that's what I wanted to leave people with. You got to look behind the crime and the drugs and the dirt and the deteriorating buildings, and you've got to look at the faces, because many of them are like you.
Well, your story embodies the American dream. Young woman, bilingual household, raised by your mother, father an alcoholic, living in the projects. But what about now? What about those who say that it is no longer possible for somebody who is growing up in that kind of environment to excel?
I think it's harder. I think it's harder in part today because the quality of education in those neighborhoods has deteriorated substantially. Mm-hmm. The cost, you know, my mom could afford, through hard work, to send my brother and I to Catholic school, first because after my dad died, we were a two-for-one, and it was $25 a month. I think it's harder because we don't have some people in these neighborhoods who are actually working directly with kids to help them see a different world and a different life. One thing that was wonderful for me in the projects is we could play outside during the day. There were no-no areas, like we couldn't go into stairwells because there was always drug paraphernalia in the stairways. But during the day, the neighborhood was safe. That doesn't exist today.
You were 9 years old when your father died. Got a question from the audience. What advice you would give to a 9-year-old girl today?
Learn to have real fun. Let me describe to you what I mean by real fun. I think that there's nothing more exciting in the world than to be curious about the world, to learn something new every single day of your life. Because when you do that, it's exciting. It's exciting to share information with people. It's exciting to know something you didn't know the day before. And sometimes it's useful. So have that kind of fun. Playing games is lovely. I play poker. You know why I play it? Because it lets me use some of my strategy and math skills. Because you have to calculate the odds of winning. Every time I'm playing with people, I get to learn something new about how to play the game better. And that's what I mean about fun. Be curious about the world. And the second bit of advice I'm going to give you at 9-year-old, you feel better when you're being nice to other people. It is really meaningful when you do a kind thing for someone else. Sometimes all it takes is seeing someone sad and saying, "I'm sorry you're sad." If you can go to sleep every night and say, "What did I learn new every night?" And every night say to yourself, "What nice thing did I do today? How did I help somebody?" You're going to have a really incredible life. You're going to be successful. You're going to have good friends. And at the end of the day, you're going to like yourself. And I don't know that there's much else to living than to end up liking you.
Já no estás más a mi lado, corazón. En el alma solo tengo soledad. Y si ya no puedo verte, porque Dios me hizo quererte para hacerme sufrir más.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor, author of My Beloved World, with some wise words for a 9-year-old girl, along with everybody else in the audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Writers on a New England Stage is a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth in collaboration with Yankee Magazine and River Run Books. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR president is Betsy Gardella. Producer and communication director is Margaret Talcott. Live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Rachel Newbar. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer is Maureen McMurray. Digital producer is Sarah Plord. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Photos from the event are posted online at Clear Eye Photo. And you can see photos and listen to audio from other author interviews from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Just click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Es la historia de un amor como no hay otro igual que me hizo comprender.